Welcome to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered. Hello, I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews of Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, here on Kansa Internet Radio, and we're ready to answer your questions about life and living it. Please remember that when we talk about answers to life's questions, all statements are intended to be helpful in a general way, and answers are of a general nature. They are not intended to take the place of personal counseling or input from a mental health professional with whom you would work directly. You can send us your questions by email. Send them to answers, A-N-S-W-E-R-S, at Andrews, Inc., that's A-N-D-R-E-W-S-I-N-C .net. You can follow us on Twitter. At Rusty Andrews is our Twitter address, and you can check us out on the Kansa Internet Radio website at Kansa Radio, that's K-O-N-Z-A, radio.org. So send your questions in. We'll change the names that you give us, so we'll make sure that you're kept in kept your privacy. And we will answer your questions, and remember that we're available here for you at answers@andrewsinc.net. Here's a question that was sent in that's about a, unfortunately, fairly common situation. And our writer says that my friend is going through a terrible divorce. I don't know what to say to him to make him feel any better about it. He sometimes breaks down in front of me and cries. What do I do? Well, this is a situation that whether it's the emotions associated with a traumatic or painful event like divorce, or the situation that arises when you're trying to be a friend and a helpful person to someone who has experienced perhaps a death or other kind of loss in their family. But it does happen very, very frequently. And I want to talk for just a few moments here about the concept of emotional boundaries, which we've visited before, but I think it's particularly appropriate in this situation. There are many times when we are faced with the pain of another person that we don't know what to say. And we don't know what to do. And unfortunately, what this results in many times is many of us just not doing anything. And because of that discomfort, we avoid people who are in pain, again, because we don't want to do or say something that's going to make it worse for them. But since we don't know what to do or say, we tend sometimes to avoid the situation. Another reason that I think that we avoid the situation is closer to the idea of emotional boundaries, and that is we have problems with other people's emotions becoming our emotions. So you're with someone who is very, very sad, they're crying, they're in a lot of pain, and that suffering becomes your suffering. Which might seem like it's a very friend kind of thing to have happen, or a very positive thing to have happen. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be able to be empathetic or sympathetic with somebody's pain that they're having. But if it becomes your pain, then you start to focus on yourself and what you can do to get rid of that pain. And so then it becomes fairly clear that one of the ways that people do occasionally deal with that pain is to avoid it. And I think that's one of the reasons that people tend to avoid others when they are in pain, is because of this issue of emotional boundaries. Obviously, one of the things to be thinking about then is the idea that we should have clearer emotional boundaries, which in a somewhat kind of paradoxical way, actually lets us be closer to other people because we can be present with them, we can be there with them, and not have to take care of our own anxiety that's being built up because of our closeness to this other person. So I think the idea of being clear about your own emotional boundaries so that you can be present with someone else and not take on their emotions is a way to be able to be with someone, first of all, that is experiencing that kind of pain. So, that said, then, specifically about this question about going through a divorce, a friend going through a terrible divorce, I think the main answer is really simply to be present. And being present requires a fair sense of emotional boundaries. So being there with that person so that they have somebody that they can talk to and someone with whom they can express their emotions in a safe, what feels like a safe environment, is really, really important. Being in that situation with that person, the help is not about you. It's about being helpful to that person. But being helpful to that person is being able to listen to them and speak words of support to them. It isn't about trying to answer their problems or tell them what to do. I think that sometimes we end up doing that, again, out of this issue of emotional boundaries, because we're trying to take care of our own anxiety. And the way we do that is to tell the person to do something that that we think will stop the pain so that we stop feeling the pain. And in fact, there's a good chance, writer, that your friend knows exactly what he needs to be doing and is probably already doing what he needs to be doing to take care of himself legally and to deal with the those kinds of issues surrounding the end of a marriage. What he really needs is someone who can be with him as he expresses that emotion. So if you were to start giving him answers saying, do this, you ought to do that, or that sort of thing, then you're actually, you may end up not being helpful in that situation. My rule of thumb is that if you feel like you need to tell somebody what you think they should be doing, the best way to handle that is to ask them if they would like you to do that and follow their lead. Certainly don't just jump in and tell them. But most of the time, in my experience, it's going to be more about you being able to be there and to listen to them and to be supportive of them, as opposed to trying to tell them what to do. They hire people to do that. They hire attorneys to do that. What they need is somebody to just be supportive. So the idea of being there and being okay with that expression of emotion, I think, is really the bottom line. In terms of things to say, I think you can, if you feel like you need to say something, is just to say that, tell your friend that you want him to know that he has your support and that you're sorry he's feeling that way, and you can ask if there's something you'd like me to do other than be here with you. I would be happy to do that if I can, and just confirm to him that you're going to be there and be with him. And I think that is really the thing that's helpful. It doesn't feel like you're really doing anything, but in reality, you're actually doing a lot. So just be there and be there with that person, and that will be a very, very, very positive thing for you to do. Don't try to tell them what to do, and don't try to fix the problem. And then lastly, be thinking about how your relationship's going to be in the future, which means you're not going to want to start speaking badly about the person who will soon be his ex-spouse, or saying any nasty sort of things like that. You don't know what's going to happen in his relationship. And so point I'm trying to make is you don't really have to get into bashing anyone, because that can tend to bounce back at you in a bad way. So, bottom line, be there for him, Be able to listen to him. Don't be worried about the fact that he's breaking down and crying in front of you. That probably says a lot about the way he sees you, and says something very positive about the fact that he sees you as a safe person with whom he can do that. So in some ways, I think you ought to take that as a compliment and think of that as a very positive thing. So remember, if you have questions, please be sure and send them to us at answers@andrewsinc.net, and we will get those addressed. And also, you can follow us again on Twitter at Rusty Andrews, and check us out on the Konza Internet Radio site at konzaradio.org. Now, in a previous program, we visited with Dr. John Fagin, who is a clinical psychologist, also at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and we began our discussion on the topic of self-esteem, which Dr. Fagin was mentioning is something that, you know, if someone's in therapy long enough, it's probably going to come up. And I invited him back again for this program so we could finish talking about it, because we just did not have the opportunity to really talk about how the treatment of self-esteem goes, even though we really spent a lot of time covering what self-esteem is and some of the issues of how it arises over the lifespan. And how it can negatively affect us. So we want to talk about how to deal with a sense of low self-esteem and move on from there. And Dr. Fagin, we welcome you back to Andrew's Answers.
Well, it's good to be back, Rusty.
And thanks for being here with us today. And we said last time that we would talk more about this issue of self-esteem and how to treat it. And I know we had to kind of cut off our discussion before, but you want to just jump in and let's discuss a little bit about that.
Well, I think it's worth it to spend a little bit of time reviewing what we talked about last time in case someone has not listened to that particular broadcast. Self-esteem is often confused with someone who seeks or has the approval of other people. They feel okay if someone else likes them, much as they started out as a very small child. The foundations of self-esteem begin in the bonding process with the primary parent, and the child adopts the parent's attitude towards them. If that bonded parent is very positive with the child, then the child begins to feel not only very safe, but also begins to accept what the other person feels about them. And for some people, it seems like that's what they have for the rest of their life. Seeking as if they're still a toddler to please other people and to gain that praise and reward and warm, fuzzy love from other people like they got from their mother or their father, whichever the primary bonded parent was. Self-esteem really begins to take on a life of its own in a third and fourth year when the sense of who we are begins to assert itself. We begin to realize we're male or we're female, or we're big or we're small, we're handsome or we're not. Even two-year-olds can tell the difference between a pretty picture and an ugly picture of
Amazing.
A human being. There just seems to be a lot of that sort of reflexive information processing in place very, very early. And then morality develops in the third and fourth year, the conscience and a sense of I'm a good person or a bad person, apart from what other people think of me. And again, part of it is just sort of adopted from the primary parent, but part of it develops spontaneously. And pre-kindergarten children can get very down on themselves and think of themselves as a very bad person, or they can begin to see themselves as a very good person when they're alone, apart from other people's opinion. And that's when self-esteem really begins to develop, is in the pre-kindergarten time. After a child is up and around on their own and they can dress themselves and go to the bathroom by themselves, they have some of those skills to take care of themselves, change the channel on the TV set, they can live alone, so to speak. But before they go to kindergarten, that's when self-esteem really takes on a life of its own. Skill building becomes very, very important as far as overcoming low self-esteem, and that can begin as early as T-ball, when you're 5 or 6 years old. If a child isn't good at one sport, a parent would be well to find something where the child can find some skill and some acceptance in a teamwork process.
Develop some sense of mastery over something.
Mastery. A child should be an expert at something, whether it's shooting marbles back in the day, or whether it's playing video games in the here and now, or whether it's soccer. The child, the parent should help the child explore and try new things until the child develops some sense of expertise at something. Because that sense of, look what I can do. All by myself, even if it's part of a team, it's still, I can be a goalie, or I can be a guard, or I can shoot hoops. That sort of skill building, riding a bicycle, anything, skating, anything, where the child can have a sense of mastery. Very, very important. And of course, then going through middle school and high school and on into college, the whole process of learning to get along with other people outside the family in a social setting. We have to help children make sure they're not stumbling all over themselves and having a lot of problems or being bullied to the point where they begin to believe what the bullies are saying. There's a certain sense of how we have to look after children to make sure they're having a fairly positive experience and that they internalize that. And that's the whole process of internalizing what happens to you and what you can do really builds on what is truly a sense of self-esteem. Sometimes a child can have an utter failure or an illness that sets them back, and it may take some real hard work on the part of the parents, or it may take some outside intervention to help them regain something that they have lost. But high school, you know, the business of wearing the right clothes and hanging out with the right people, and then when you get a driver's license, if you have a junker of a car, if you have a really slick machine, that gets a lot of approval from other people, perhaps, a lot of acceptance. But it can substitute for self-esteem, and what that word I made up of other esteem.
Yes.
Or it certainly can add to one's sense of self. You see a lot of what's going on with self-esteem at the point when a child is ready to leave home. Whether they are calm and courageous and planning ahead with hope and dignity, or whether they're trying to act out their conflicts and misbehave, they're trying to distract themselves from really thinking about and planning for the future. Those older teens, young adults with high self-esteem, charge forward with a plan. They are confident they're going to be able to make it. Even if they change horses in midstream, they can still have some sense that I've been okay for 18 years and I'll still be okay for the next 18 years. But kids who have low self-esteem oftentimes wind up partying or changing schools too often or changing majors too often or just never really applying themselves to get the kind of grades that they need to be able to make those stepping stones and move forward.
They're still stuck in that place of being looking for other people to validate them. And now they've lost all those people, and their choice is, do I find a whole new set of people to validate me, or do I figure out a way to validate myself?
Well, if you think of an 18-year-old senior leaving home who had the validation of parents and grandparents and cousins and church and school, and then suddenly they find themselves in a university atmosphere, yes, they have to look, and sometimes they find very poor substitutes from what they had in their home community, or very self-destructive distractions from the lack of support that they had previously. So we see in the transitions, that's when we see a lot of struggle. And of course, the transition of turning 40 or whatever age, some people crisis at 35, some at 45, but we target 40. And we see problems there to a great extent, where people who may have gotten their validation from family, then from good grades at school, then from career, suddenly begin to feel very empty, suddenly begin to feel very alone, because what has soothed them for so many years is just not soothing enough anymore. And so, in fact, most of the clients that come into my office, however they may present, they usually are struggling with self-esteem, because it seems that people with high self-esteem tackle their problems pretty much on their own, or they'll get some advice from someone else, or they'll maybe they'll come in for one or two sessions, or just some reality check, if you will, with an mm-hmm. outsider. Mm-hmm. But those who stay beyond a couple of sessions usually have issues of low self-esteem. Mm-hmm. It was something I didn't learn in graduate school, but I certainly have learned in the real life of trying to work with people.
Very good. Okay, well, that's a great summary of where we've been so far. We want to talk a little bit about how to move on from that and how to develop it, because it isn't a hopeless situation. It isn't something that you just have to live with low self-esteem for the rest of your life. There are ways to deal with that. And we will talk about those things in just a few moments, but we do want to take a break and remind you again that you can send us an email with your questions about self-esteem or any other topic by sending an email to answers, A-N-S-W-E-R-S, at Andrews, Inc., A-N-D-R-E-W-S-I-N-C, .net. You are listening to Andrews Answers, Life's Questions Answered, on Kanza Internet Radio.
Something. And then we went down by a stream and perched up on this huge rock and saw all these little minnows swimming around way below us. And then I rescued my little brother from an evil slug king who was guarding him at the bush fortress. And my sister and I brought him back to our super twig fort for safety. And then we all laid out and told stories until it got dark. And the Big Dipper led us all the way home.
Wow. Awesome.
Where were you, Jill?
Yeah. We went to the forest. It's not that far away. Anyone want to come this weekend?
Ask your parents to take you and your friends to the forest this week and find the fun, adventurous you. It's closer than you think. Check out discovertheforest.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered, here on Kanza Internet Radio. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews, here with Dr. John Fagin, both of us from Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. And Dr. Fagin, we were talking earlier about self-esteem and sort of going over some things from our previous program on it about where problems with self-esteem arise or from whence they arise. But today we want to talk more about how to treat self-esteem, what people can do. It is not a hopeless thing. Just because you have low self-esteem as an adult doesn't mean you're always going to be in that position.
Absolutely true. What we're talking about can take place in a treatment office, or people can adapt the same kinds of things and do it at home in sort of a self-help way. Mm-hmm. There are certainly many self-help books out there that may or may not be helpful. I have not read any of them recently and mm-hmm. have none to recommend, mm-hmm. But I'm sure there's bound to be some out
yes.
there. But the main thing is to think about moving from people-pleasing and seeking the approval of other people to learning to be alone mm-hmm. and learning to validate themselves. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things that I try to do with people is to try to understand briefly how long this low self-esteem has been there and how serious it is. Because if it's been there all their lives, it's going to be a lot more struggle to build something new. If they seem to have some sense of self-esteem or self-worth and lost it because of some backslide or some crisis, it's easier to kind of recapture what they had before.
They know what it feels like, so I can do that again. They need the encouragement to go back there.
Absolutely. One of the big mistakes people make is to compare themselves with other people. Mm-hmm. We always seem to be looking at our neighbor, and that guy can shoot better hoops than I can, and that person has more income than I do, or this person went farther in school than I did. That sort of comparison with other people is just deadly. Mm-hmm. Because no matter what you do, there's always somebody who can do it better, and you're bound to see them. And ironically, we don't tend to look at our neighbor and say, well, I do that better than him, so I can feel well. Mm-hmm. Or I went further in school than she, so I can feel proud of that. We always tend to look at the half-empty glass rather than the half-full glass when we make those comparisons with other people. So one of the things we have to learn to do is compare ourselves with ourselves. That, okay, if perhaps I could type 30 words a minute last week, but I can type 35 words a minute this week. So that's something to feel good about. In fact, it reminds me of some research, a small piece of research that was done where in a university setting, they had people word process, and one group, they praised them, and one group, they criticized them. No matter what they did, they pushed the other group to do better. And the critical, the group that was criticized or pushed did poorly, and the ones that were validated did better. But that's, again, seeking approval from other people or criticism from other people, which we need to learn to do that to ourselves.
Yeah, it's the same principle you're talking about. It's just you need to do it self.
We have to internalize it. Yes. We have to remind ourselves, what I'm doing is okay. I may be able to do it better. If I try hard enough, I might be able to. But learning to accept ourselves as we are doesn't seem to be part of our culture. There's always this sense of upward mobility. No matter how much money I'm making, I should make more next year. Or no matter what house I live in, I should do better next year and upgrade to a nicer car, nicer house, nicer clothes. And that's just part of our culture and part of our whole economy. Our economy is driven on the backs of unhappy people who have to consume and consume and consume to try to feel better. And so some people actually spend more money than they earn trying to feel better again. But it's an external validation of consuming something or having something that other people envy.
And then get into debt and not feel good, which is exactly a parallel to what you were talking about, that if you're validated outside of yourself, you'll probably never be able to make it. If you're validated within yourself, you can actually succeed and feel better.
And we touched on that a bit in the last show when we talked about not praising children, but teaching a child to praise himself or herself. Teaching that sense of you can be proud of what you just did. Look at your success, as opposed to you make daddy so happy when you do that. If a child has a good ball game, you know, validating, helping the child validate, okay, you made a couple of mistakes, but you did well in seven innings, even if you had trouble in two innings. So you can feel good about seven innings, even if you made some mistakes. And that's sort of what we need to internalize. We need to sort of make a list of what we see as our strengths and our challenges and focus on improving our strengths and decreasing our challenges. But it turns out that most people focus on the negatives. There was an interesting book reviewed in yesterday's Manhattan Mercury, and it talked about, the reviewer talked about, the author had written that there seems to be some survival benefit, sort of an instinctive survival benefit to always paying attention to the negatives, because then we will avoid them, hopefully, and we will not get ourselves in danger in the future. And so there seems to be some survival value to this business of always looking at the dark side of our lives and always concentrating on the negatives. And I think I mentioned before, there's been some research that says that we should always go through our family photo albums. We mm-hmm. should always remind ourselves of the good days that mm-hmm. we had, the happy birthdays we had, or mm-hmm. the celebrations, or how cute we were on Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
That we need to remind ourselves of the good part of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We have to accept that we're not perfect. We have to accept our challenges and work on those. But again, we have to make sure we're not obsessively focusing on the mistakes of the past
mm-hmm.
or the imperfections in our current lives.
Mm-hmm.
And getting people to validate themselves is probably the toughest part of my job. Getting people to look at the bright side of life and to verbally, or if not truly, look in a mirror and say, what's good about me?
Mm-hmm.
What can I like about myself? What do I like best about myself? What do I want to portray? Not so much to get a response from other people, but just so that I can feel good about what I've done today.
Mm-hmm. And getting your head in that positive place doesn't mean being Pollyanna-ish and ignoring the fact that you have challenges and things that you need to improve on. But I tell the story of getting your head in the right direction where when I was in third grade or just after third grade, I had my first swimming class. And my mom decided I should learn how to swim, so I went to swimming class, and after we'd been in class for a few days, we finally got to the point where we could go into the deep water, and the teacher was trying to tell us how to swim to the bottom, teach us how to swim to the bottom and swim back up, again giving us some sense of mastery over the ability to take care of ourselves in the water. And all of us were flailing around in the water. We could float well. We were very buoyant third graders. And we could float really, really well. We were all kicking like crazy trying to get to the bottom. But none of us were going down there. And the teacher said, well, your head's not pointed in the right direction. Point your head, look at the bottom, point your head in that way and kick and you'll go down. So we started to do that, and sure enough, we found ourselves at the bottom of the swimming pool and swam back up. And I really think that sort of applies to a lot of things in terms of self-esteem, that if you keep your head pointed in the negative direction and thinking about how bad you are, that's where you're going to go. But if you can find it within yourself and be encouraged to actually look at the positive, and then you keep kicking, well, you're going to end up more there than the other.
Absolutely. It certainly helps you build skills, and that builds confidence. I would tell a similar kind of story about swimming. I was 12 and hadn't learned to swim because we lived in the country and had been basically told to be afraid of water, that people drown and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. But it was time. We'd moved to town, and it was time to learn to swim, and I just couldn't make myself do it. Until I borrowed a swim mask, mm-hmm. and could look under the surface and look around,
mm-hmm.
and then suddenly all my fears went away.
Ah, it wasn't the mysterious, scary place.
Right, right. Ah. So sometimes if we can, using that as a metaphor, if we have a realistic view of the future, mm-hmm. a realistic view of the things that are our challenges,
mm-hmm.
sometimes it takes away the fear, and then we can move ahead much more mm-hmm. appropriately. But yeah. I like your story. Get your head in the right direction.
Yeah, and then there you go.
Well, the main thing also is to, I think it helps people to journal, to
yes,
remind themselves mm-hmm. of what their strengths are and what they're actually working on, and be able to document baby steps of progress.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people have A to Z plans. You know, they want to go, I'm going to lose 100 pounds in the next year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a plan. That's a dream.
Yeah.
And so people need to make stepwise, I'll lose 2 pounds a week.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll do it in this way, by mm-hmm. exercising X number of moments a day mm-hmm. or hours a day. That's an ABC plan that mm-hmm. allows people to be successful. And that allows people to see the progress, however slowly, mm-hmm. and to feel good about what they can do.
Mm-hmm.
And so learning to plan appropriately, learning to have appropriate expectations of themselves. But again, all too often we want too much too soon, and mm-hmm. then we become disappointed, and our self-esteem can go even lower.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to make sure that we are setting goals for positive change and that they are realistic enough that we have some hope of achieving them.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes that is going to take some outside coaching, isn't it?
Oftentimes we seem to need the guidance or support of a friend or a family member or sometimes even a professional if we become so discouraged mm-hmm. that we tend to give up way too fast and then to be overly self-critical. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes when people backslide a little bit, they become horribly self-critical mm-hmm. and they need that reality check of an outside person. Oh, this wasn't as bad as you're portraying it. Mm-hmm. This is just a minor setback. You can recoup your success and get back on track quickly. But as I said before, people tend to focus on the negatives. Mm-hmm. No matter what they do, no matter how much success they have, they tend to focus on the negatives. And that seems to have become sort of a habit or a trait that is deeply ingrained mm-hmm. in their personality. And sometimes we need someone outside of us, such as a professional, to remind us. You know, in the last 50 minutes, you have been self-critical so many times, X, mm-hmm. Y, or Z times. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of how harsh you are with yourself? And mm-hmm. sometimes they're not. Mm-hmm. They're just blind to their own internal messages, mm-hmm. that internal dialogue we talked about before. That it is so habitually negative, they're not even aware mm-hmm. that they're destroying themselves 8 hours or 24 hours a day by looking at the dark side, looking at mm-hmm. the mistakes, mm-hmm. and ignoring the good things that they've done.
So they are with someone who is able to more or less accurately reflect what they see is really going on, and the person can, like looking in an emotional mirror in a sense, that they can see that I didn't even realize I was that negative. I've gotten myself so stuck in this pattern that it seems like normal.
Well, there's some parallels to that that are worth talking about, I think, is that some of us become very hypercritical of our spouse or our children. Mm-hmm. We tend to focus only on the negatives uh-huh. and think it's our God-given right to always make sure we communicate our thoughts and feelings to mm-hmm. everyone. And so we tend to not only be negative with ourselves, we tend to be negative with other people. And so then they don't necessarily be very warm to us. They don't mm-hmm. necessarily give us very much positive feedback mm-hmm. either. Typically, what you feel on the inside is the way you act on the outside, mm-hmm. typically. So if you are hypercritical of yourself, if you're always looking at the dark side of yourself and never seeing the good that you're doing, you're probably going to treat other people that way. Mm-hmm. And that sort of negative environment, that sort of negative feedback that you get certainly makes it that much tougher to feel good about yourself. Mm-hmm. Because it seems like everybody's always being critical of you in return or always being negative or just mm-hmm. ignoring you. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes we can get a sense of what's going on inside of a person by watching how they treat other people. Mm-hmm. And then we can intervene at that level too. Mm-hmm. We can say, you know, in the coming week, I want you to focus on the positive that your child does or mm-hmm. or your spouse does. Mm-hmm. And I want you to make sure you comment on that at least 4 times a day or 6 times a day or mm-hmm. whatever seems to be appropriate. Because if we can get people to begin looking for the good in other people, mm-hmm. that also can become a habit of mm-hmm. looking for the good in ourselves.
But establishing that new habit, because you're right, that old habit or that looking at the negative has become the rut that we're in, and we need to make a new rut.
Absolutely. That's a nice way of putting it, making mm-hmm. a new rut. That we need to find a path, we need to find a goal, we need to insist to ourselves, and then monitor it. And mm-hmm. and check ourselves at the end of the day. Okay, how many times did I compliment my child? Mm-hmm. How many times did I compliment my mm-hmm. spouse? How many times did I say something positive to myself mm-hmm. as opposed to how negative was I today?
Yeah.
I've read various places that it takes 30 days to build a new habit, and mm-hmm. I think that's maybe optimistic, but it's certainly a good start. Mm-hmm. You know, if we can ask a person to be more positive over 4 sessions over the next 4 weeks, mm-hmm. we might actually have some significant impact mm-hmm. on a person's life. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's easier to start out being nicer to other people
than to yourself.
To yourself, mm-hmm. absolutely, because mm-hmm. we tend to be so self-critical mm-hmm. And because we're more aware of our mistakes than anyone else, presumably, if other people are more aware of your mistakes than you are, that could get you in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, that's a different program.
That's a different program.
All right. Well, we're going to take another break here and come back and talk a little bit more about self-esteem and developing it in yourself or with the help of someone else. And we remind you that you can send your questions to us via email at answers@andrewsinc.net. You're listening to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered, here on Konza Internet Radio.
My name is Sue Smith. I'm 38 years old, and I work at a graphic design company, which is funny, because I couldn't even draw a stick figure when I was a kid. But I met someone who told me, you know what, you can do anything if you really want to. And if the teenage me were here, she'd tell you,
I wouldn't be into drawing and art if it wasn't for big brothers, big sisters. Most kids from my neighborhood don't get into art. They get into trouble. But I was lucky, because my big sister showed me early on that I didn't have to be like most people. And to the young me,
that meant a lot. My big sister's name is Sheila, and Sheila is the reason that this 8-year-old grows up to have an amazing job as a graphic designer.
Whether you donate money or time, you're helping big brothers, big sisters help a child. And that can last a lifetime. Start something today at bigbrothersbigsisters.org. Brought to you by Big Brothers Big Sisters and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Lisa Edelstein. Every day on set, I help my fictional doctors save the lives of imaginary patients in the TV series House. Every day in his village in Ethiopia, Barasa Ware helps save the lives of real children as a local health worker. Like many children in the developing world, the ones in Barasa's village are threatened by common illnesses that kill millions worldwide. But unlike villages without a local health worker, the children of Barasa's village get the care they need to survive. Imagine how many more children could be saved with your help. When you help local health workers like Barasa, you help children survive all over the world. See where the good goes at goodgoes.org and find out all the ways you can help the good go further. Brought to you by Save the Children and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Science Today. And we already have our next caller. Welcome. Who's this?
Hi, I'm Philip.
Hello, Philip. You sound really young.
Not really. I'm 9.
Oh, wow. You're still in elementary school, right?
Does that matter?
Oh, no, not at all. What's your question?
Well, I know the molecular formula for water is H2O. I also know that hydrocarbon is CH3CH250CH3. Glucose is C6H12O6. The general formula for an alkene is CnH2n+2. But what I can't seem to find is any scientific formula for Bob.
Bob?
My goldfish.
Are you ready for kids who eat healthy? Good nutrition can lead to great things. To find out how a healthy lifestyle can help your child succeed, go to mypyramid.gov. A public service announcement brought to you by the Ad Council and USDA.
Welcome back to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered, here on Konza Internet Radio. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews, talking today with Dr. John Fagen, both of us from Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas, and we're talking about and wrapping up our two-hour conversation regarding self-esteem. And Dr. Fagen, I was thinking about the idea that perhaps one of the things we fear more than anything else in our lives is looking like a fool and somebody saying that we're not doing well when we thought we were. And the easiest way to avoid that is to think we don't do very well, so our opinion of ourselves is always lower than everybody else's, and we protect ourselves from ever looking like the fool, which then feeds into a low sense of self-esteem.
I think that's absolutely correct. People when they're aware that they're making a mistake, don't seem to be quite as hurt by criticism mm-hmm. as when they think they're doing well,
mm-hmm.
and then it's pointed out that they're not. It's, mm-hmm. it's sort of a betrayal of the self to be that naive or mm-hmm. foolish, mm-hmm. to think that you're saying the right thing or you're dressed appropriately, and then someone points out that you're out of time or out of touch or you've mm-hmm. committed some huge social faux pas by speaking in such a manner.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you that if we don't elevate ourselves,
mm-hmm.
then it's like if I criticize myself first, then it won't hurt so much when someone else criticizes me.
Mm-hmm.
But there's sort of a tip-over point where once you start to gain self-esteem, you really don't care what the other person says.
Yeah.
and if you uh-huh. become foolish at times, you don't worry about it because mm-hmm. you're human and you're not mm-hmm. going to be perfect all the time.
Mm-hmm. You're so, able to forgive yourself.
Absolutely. So mm-hmm. when you have low self-esteem, You don't want to ever appear foolish, like you're foolishly thinking you're successful and someone else points out that you're way off base.
Mm-hmm.
You're very vulnerable to that with low self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
The higher the self-esteem, the less vulnerable you are to other people's opinions. You certainly would listen to them. You would certainly mm-hmm. take them into account. But you value your own opinion more highly than anyone else's. And mm-hmm. therefore, you're not quite so much a people pleaser, and you're not quite so fearful in new situations where you might think you're succeeding and you're not.
So it's that, it really is, as in most things in life, it is that sense of balance between having self-esteem, and that's where the self-judgment comes from, is based upon how you're thinking about yourself internally, but you still attend to the thoughts and speech of other people just to see if you're on track, I suppose, with your own self-assessment.
When you have high self-esteem, you listen to the feedback of other people or just the reactions of other people, both positively and mm-hmm. negatively.
Mm-hmm.
If you have low self-esteem, you'll pick out all the negatives that people mm-hmm. are saying, and you'll mm-hmm. ignore all the neutral or positive mm-hmm. reactions that mm-hmm. you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have low self-esteem, it sort of feeds on itself. You always mm-hmm. look for the negative, and you find it.
Mm-hmm.
You hear the negatives selectively mm-hmm. in the feedback you get from other people
mm-hmm.
So that you don't get fooled. But we have to remind ourselves that high self-esteem is not conceit.
Yes.
Conceit says, I'm better than everyone else.
Yes.
And how I might value, I have a better skill than anyone else in this shooting hoops or mm-hmm. playing golf or whatever. Mm-hmm. I may be the most skilled, but that doesn't make me a better person.
Mm-hmm.
And just because we have high self-esteem doesn't mean we are conceited and we look down on other people.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the lower your self-esteem, the more comparison by judgment you're
yes.
going to do, like mm-hmm. we talked about before, mm-hmm. and the higher your self-esteem, the less comparison or judgment you're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be judging other people. You're mm-hmm. just going to look for the good in them and enjoy that mm-hmm. and try to elevate them to some degree. But you're not always going to be hyper-alert, looking for the possible criticism and always comparing yourself, am I good enough?
Mm-hmm.
And how will this other person like me or not?
Mm-hmm.
So low self-esteem people are very, very emotionally crippled in the sense that they're always focused on other people
mm-hmm.
and they're always focused on trying to get other people's appraisal or approval,
mm-hmm.
that positive feedback from other people to substitute for their self-esteem. So they're very busy people trying to manipulate situations and other mm-hmm. people to mm-hmm. get a positive feedback.
Mm-hmm.
When you have high self-esteem, you become less concerned, and
mm-hmm.
so you focus on what you can do to make the world a better place
mm-hmm.
instead of trying to find a way for other people to make your life better for you.
So, again, seems a bit of a paradox, but the reality is that the higher a person's true self-esteem, the more willing, more able, and probably more appropriately they're able to pay attention to the opinions of other people.
Absolutely. One of the ways that we can feel good is to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
I've often said, actually I didn't make this up, I'm echoing someone else, but
mm-hmm.
the only value we have as humans is how we treat other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are we selfish and grasping and grabbing and mm-hmm. taking advantage?
Mm-hmm.
Or are we generous and altruistic and really truly caring and trying to make our planet a better place?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes the way we gain better self-esteem is to act as if we have it.
Mm-hmm.
We do what other people do who actually have self-esteem, sort of fake it till you make it.
Yes.
you start being generous for the right reasons. You strive to have the right attitude when you're being caring. You show generosity without any hope of feedback by mm-hmm. giving money to charities mm-hmm. or by doing some community service where your name is not in the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
The more you start to focus on the welfare of other people, you can truly feel better about yourself because, one, you're not focused on all the negatives in your life,
mm-hmm.
and two, you're actually doing something meaningful that, mm-hmm. that may have a long-term impact.
Mm-hmm.
So we can feel good about those sorts of behaviors that we have that aren't just self-centered, totally
mm-hmm.
self-centered.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was saying a little bit earlier, that's the huge difference between someone with low self-centered, low self-esteem. They're totally self-centered.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about me and mm-hmm. how you treat me and how you make me feel. And people with high self-esteem are always focused on what's going on around them.
And another practical way to start to build this a sense of higher self-esteem is, following along with what you said, to practice actually receiving compliments.
Very good. One of my graduate school professors noted that whenever she gave compliments, the students tended to thwart them or to ignore
mm-hmm.
them. I think it was in statistics class, it was really an unusual situation, but she took it upon herself to make sure that all of us could accept a compliment.
Mm-hmm.
Because if we do feel good about ourselves, we do accept the positive feedback that
mm-hmm.
other people give us.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, if we have low self-esteem, we tend to ignore or to sort of shred mm-hmm. a compliment. Oh, this, oh, it's nothing, mm-hmm. it means nothing. Or
we really feel uncomfortable emotionally with a compliment.
Perfectly said.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't match our own sense mm-hmm. of what's real and what's not
mm-hmm.
real. And one of the ways you can find out if you're meeting someone and you want to know what their self-esteem is, you
mm-hmm.
can give them a compliment
mm-hmm.
and see if they accept it gracefully or
mm-hmm.
if they shrug it off. One of the other things we can do to improve our self-esteem is to accept personal responsibility for our feelings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in our culture, the language says, you make me mad, you make me so
yes.
happy, you make me so proud,
uh-huh.
Which is what we say to little children when they're 2 and 3 and 4 years old.
Mm-hmm.
But most people stay stuck in that. And so if they're unhappy, they blame their spouse or they blame
mm-hmm.
their child,
mm-hmm.
and they feel like victims.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the interventions that I use all the time is making sure that people take responsibility for their own feelings. How can I make myself feel better in this situation that isn't going well?
Mm-hmm.
Or how can I not make myself feel badly
mm-hmm.
in this situation?
Mm-hmm.
Because if we take that personal responsibility, it's my job to make me feel good.
Mm-hmm.
Then I stay focused on what can I do to better my life
mm-hmm.
and to feel better about my life.
Mm-hmm.
If I really believe it's your job to make me happy, I'm going to be focused on you.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how nice you are to me, it's never going to be enough.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to make me happy enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm always going to wonder, what's wrong with me? Why won't he make me happy? Or why won't she make me feel good?
Mm-hmm.
Or... So we don't feel like victims when
mm-hmm.
we don't feel like we're in the control of other people. We're not always seeking that approval from them if we learn to feel good
mm-hmm.
all by ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in cultures past, there was a transition where youngsters became adults by going out into the wilderness by themselves and
mm-hmm.
learning to feel good about their skills and learning to regulate their own emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And the shaman would come out and give them advice from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
But when they came back to the tribe, they were adults.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have that in our culture. We don't have a clear rite of passage about how to become a self-sufficient adult.
Mm-hmm.
We see people who are 30 or 40 years old who are still dependent on family for emotional or financial support
mm-hmm.
Or for guidance about what to do or what not to do. We need to find a way in this culture for people to transition from a dependent child to a strong, self-sufficient, self-regulating, independent adult.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big challenge.
It is. And one of the things you mentioned brought to my mind the idea that it's okay to feel okay. That sometimes people think, I have to stay in this emotionally distraught place because of my situation, when in fact, by doing so, they're actually helping keep that situation going in a bad way. But if there are good things happening, or there's a way that you can help yourself to feel good, that's okay. And it doesn't mean you're saying everything that's going on around you is all right, you don't want to make any changes, you're not accepting your low position or whatever. You just are taking advantage of the opportunity to feel okay, to celebrate some good thing that's happened, that you've done.
You know, when people come in, if I ask them, is it okay if you're the happiest person in your family? And that's about the response I get.
Yeah.
Oh, heavens no.
Yeah, yeah.
There's just something in our culture, or at least in parts of our culture, that says that, particularly for adult females, that it is not okay for them to be happier than their spouse or their children.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow they're supposed to be one step lower than everyone else, and to try to make the other family members' lives better.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a great resistance in adult females to change their self-esteem.
Mm-hmm. Not take care of themselves.
They just don't seem to have their own permission to take care of themselves first.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, in a survival situation, you take care of yourself first so you can help other people.
That's what the stewards at the airplane say. If the mask falls from the ceiling, put yours on first, because if you don't put yours on first, you'll pass out and you and the person next to you will both die.
That's an excellent metaphor, but for some reason in our culture, adult females have a very, very difficult time taking care of themselves. It is almost as if they feel like it's someone else's job to make them happy, and it's their job to make other people happy, and so everyone is miserable.
And that is that kind of dependence isn't the kind of interdependence that you were referring to when you talked about doing something for the good of society and helping and making the world a better place, which is more of an interdependency thing. But that's a very much a complete dependence on someone else, an inability to be with myself.
I would call it more of an enmeshment or
yes.
a fusion,
mm-hmm.
where I scratch your back and you scratch mine,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to in a high-functioning person with high self-esteem, they become altruistic. They become
mm-hmm.
helpful with no sense of what am I going to get back from
mm-hmm.
this other person,
mm-hmm.
and no sense of reciprocity. You do the right thing for the good reason instead of making it just a trade.
Yeah,
I'll do something nice for you if you do something nice for me. It is sometimes extremely challenging to get. Let's face it, most of our clients are adult females.
Mm-hmm.
Males may come in, but oftentimes when they come in, they're in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Adult females are wise enough to seek to improve things, to seek support, and to accept feedback
mm-hmm.
from a therapist. And so the most opportunity we have to impact is by working with these females who have been told from childhood, apparently, that they are a second-class citizen and they must take care of everyone else and hope in return that the prince will make them happy
mm-hmm.
In a Cinderella format.
Mm-hmm.
So trying to help them develop a sense of self is quite a challenge, quite rewarding. They learn quickly if they're willing to make a change.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that is true in a management situation is that if you reward and punish people, and if you praise and criticize people, in the short run, you can manage them. You can manage your
mm-hmm.
children, you can manage your spouse,
mm-hmm.
or you can manage a work situation with reward and punishment and praise and punishment. But it certainly doesn't develop self-esteem at home or in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we want to raise self-esteem, we must point out, look what you did. You did it well. You can feel great about that.
Mm-hmm.
And keep the parent's point of view out of it, or the therapist's point of view.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as therapists, we're trained never compliment your client. Never tell them you're proud of them. Never tell them that they did a good job, because that way they'll just have to keep coming back to you for the next 40 years
mm-hmm.
to refill their gas tank of approval seeking. As therapists, we're taught to teach people to validate themselves and to become independent in that regard. And that's the way we should work in the workplace, in a friendship situation, in a marital situation, in a parenting situation. We always encourage people to validate themselves.
And to be, yes, and to be their own best therapist.
Absolutely. I need a job, but it's really good to see people take care of themselves.
To be good therapists themselves. Well, thank you, Dr. Fagin, for visiting with us about self-esteem on these two programs. And if you're listening to us on the live stream, didn't catch the earlier program, you know that you can go to the website, Konza Radio, KONZA Radio.org, and there will be a link there where you can, on demand, play the earlier program or play any of our program here on Andrew's Answers. You have been listening to Andrew's Answers. I'm Dr. Rusty Andrews, licensed clinical marriage and family therapist at Andrews & Associates in Manhattan, Kansas. You can follow us on Twitter at Rusty Andrews. Check out our webpage at konzaradio.org and send us questions that you would like answered or addressed at answers@andrewsinc.net. Andrew's Answers is produced by Megan Andrews, and you have been listening to Andrew's Answers, Life's Questions Answered, here on Konza Internet Radio.